Hello.
Good evening.
Good evening, Dan.
Hi.
Hi.
Sup?
How are you?
Full of wonderful Mexican food. How are you?
I am a little mentally
drained.
I just came off of the 2-hour low definition episode that transpired. And at the end, I don't want to give away any spoilers, but I might have given up a tiny bit. it's exciting though, because I have totally smartly scheduled a movie to talk about, which is always a good thing to do, because I like talking about movies with you, Dan.
Do you want to not?
No, I totally want to talk about this movie, Dan, because I've watched it over the course of 2 days. Because I was very serious about my prep work, and I was worried about my rental expiring in time and not being able to watch it, and if we had to shift days or something like that. So I bought it. I own Predator 2.
See, okay, so at this point, I feel like I should apologize, because clearly my memory of the movie was, I don't know, diffused through the years or something. I don't know. I remembered the things that occurred in the movie. I just didn't really remember how they occurred and all of the things that surround the things that... this movie is not good, is what I'm saying. And I'm sorry, because I thought it was better than it is. Then it's not good.
No, it's awful. But you see, the interesting thing is I have... I watched this most recently after having watched Predators on TV over the weekend.
Right, because, yes. That I encouraged you to watch, because it's always good to watch a giant train wreck of a movie, but this is a different encouragement.
Yes, I feel after having watched both of these rather recently, that I have some opinions about where they place amongst other things, because Predator 2 is a hot mess of a movie. And it is a scattered, all over the place, wacky, throw lots of ideas at the wall, and also a bunch of derivative stuff from other films. And it's sort of interesting in that way. Whereas I feel like after having watched Predators recently, which I'm not sure if we're going to run out and do an episode on at any point, but
based on what I remember of the movie, we really shouldn't waste anyone's time.
No, in summation, it is a poorly done retread of the first movie, but like with a little twist. And it has Lawrence Fishburne, who shows up from a completely different film for a little bit and then leaves. And it's a bit of a different kind of a mess than Predator 2 is. And I feel in many ways that Predators was less ambitious, even though it had a larger budget and it had more actors that were, you know, big catchy names, and they
bigger than Gary Busey and Bill Paxton,
this coach, and so, you know, it's got that going on, and it still managed to be a predictable mess where there is no point in the film where you're like, yes, I'm totally surprised by this event that has occurred on screen, which I never could have predicted. And with Predators 2, I'm sorry, with Predator 2, God, I hope they never make a sequel to Predator, Predators. But the Predator 2 sequel, it has some different kinds of ambition about what it's doing and tries to twist a little bit of what the original did in a different way. It does reuse many elements, but then it's like, hey, you know what? Let's make a spike thing, and then we'll make a frisbee thing, and we'll do some stuff, you know. So there's some ingenuity about it in those kinds of ways, and we certainly see more of the Predator stalking around and killing people in this one than we do in the other film. And it's also interesting to me in that it walks this very strange line of being progressive and also horribly, horribly stereotyped regressive on the other side. Because you've got Danny Glover in your lead role. you've got Maria Cachito Alonso and Ruben Blades as the main supporting characters. But at the same time, you have these horrible stereotypes about some weird drug war and like a whole thing about voodoo. All the voodoo stuff is just awful.
The Colombian drug folks from the opening scene of this movie could not be more cartoonish caricatures of non-existent stereotypes. They're very, very bad. Like, it wasn't terrible until they like went back into the building to like rearm, and the guy just like grabbed a handful of cocaine and like shoved it into his face to like re-energize himself. Like, he is literally a video game character, like eating a mushroom to one-up himself.
Yeah. And also after he does that, he smacks his coke laden hand on his shoulder with a big nice white handprint. And mm-hmm. So you know, it's to let you know they mean serious business.
Yeah,
because they're cooked up drug fiends, and I don't know.
It's terrible.
It is really weird how they chose to have these two competing sorts of things, where you have sort of this progressive, interesting police department in some respects, and then you have this horrible stereotype cartoon, thoughtless garbage happening on the streets, and it's just like, this is very weird. And you also have all kinds of other peculiarities that I would describe to people who might be more familiar with New York writing a movie in Los Angeles, because the subway is featured heavily in a movie about Los Angeles.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, sure. Oh, of course.
Especially like, because he's like, you know, take the subway out to this stop and then I'll pick you up in my car. Like, why wouldn't you just go pick them up wherever they are? Like, that's not... you're not that far away. But
yeah, and there's the meatpacking district, which is right next to your apartment homes, where a little old lady lives, and she wants Herb to come and check who's in the bathroom. Like, this movie is just all over the place.
I bet you there wasn't even a Herb in that other room.
No, she's imagining Herb. Herb's been dead for years.
Maybe she was the predator all along, and Herb was just hanging upside down from the ceiling.
Do you think she lived next to the meatpacking plant?
Ooh.
Yeah.
Hide the cold snow. Storage. Yeah, exactly. That's all of the good psychos have that sort of innate sense of where to live and where to hide their stuff. Anyway, so this, as well as Predators, both of those movies suffer from the same problem, wherein the filmmaker said, Predator is great. Everyone remembers the original. Everyone loves Predator. What can we do to change and make a new, fresh story without changing the overall, you know, the universe that this world lives in? So let's strip away everything except the monster and the sort of rules about what the monster is killing for, which is basically, again, it's hinted at. They never get directly at it. It's, you know, he's fighting to be top of the food chain, king of the hill kind of stuff. And he wants to challenge the biggest prey around, and then he keeps his little souvenirs and whatever. He'll move on and stuff. But everything else can change. So in Predators... the new one that you saw that was terrible, they're like, well, why don't we take them off planet Earth and let's put them somewhere else, and then we'll grab all of the best bad guys from all around Earth and put them in one place, and we'll have like a group fight off thing, and it'll be great. And in this one, it's like, well, the first one was great, but let's take them out of the jungle, let's take them into an urban environment where there's all kinds of crime and stuff. And it's like, well, you're still kind of violating a lot of the things that would sort of make sense in the Predator's world. Like, they're not really viewing it through the world of, you know, why would the Predator go to these places and do these things? Like, they try to sort of justify it again with this whole like hot summer thing. Like, it's 109 degrees in Los Angeles and there's crime galore, and he's attracted to heat and conflict. Like, what with the heat? Why do we need the heat? I don't know why, of all of the things they carried on forward, that they brought that one. Is it because his infrared vision only works when temperatures above like 80 degrees or something? Like, it's the dumbest thing possible, other than the fact that they just wanted Danny Glover to sweat through all of his wardrobe. I don't understand it in the slightest.
Well, of course, you needed to see Bill Paxton's armpit stains through his suit blazer.
And his shirt collar out on top of his jacket collar, which is something you should never, ever do.
Well, that was the style in 1997, because as you remember, this movie is from 1990.
Oh, right. This is 1997 Los Angeles. Seven years in the future.
7 years in the future when everything has gone to crap and the inner city gang warfare is through the roof and television cameras are rampant on the streets.
Yeah, right, exactly. And, you know, not only is it 109 degrees in Los Angeles, but he lives in, well, he hangs out and has lunch in the meatpacking building where it's nice and cool, presumably. But I don't know. I feel like from the first movie, it was just like, well, he goes to the jungle because that's where all of these drug lords or whatever, these despots just are roaming around and there's people to hunt and kill. But like, how do we make it feel even more like a jungle in Los Angeles? Well, we'll make it hot, too. It's like you didn't need that. It adds a really kind of weird backdrop to everything. And then, of course, you've got the additional subtext backdrop of this whole like government conspiracy, like they know that Predator is a thing but they want to steal its technology, which is also stupid.
That could be completely removed from this movie. Like
it should be, aside from the fact that it's really awesome to see Gary Busey, spoiler, get his head sliced off with the thing.
You don't even see it. It's behind a cow.
I know, and yet it's one of those things that I specifically remember seeing when I was younger and then being disappointed every time I saw the TV edit where you didn't see the giant bucket of blood that falls next to his body. Like I always liked that the way they did that because, you know, the slow motion cutting through the cows and stuff and then the sploosh of the blood. But it was nice.
Yeah. Well, one thing, though, Los Angeles is already like a jungle. Because, you know, we've got fun and games.
Oh, God. I didn't see that coming. I did. yeah, you got your fun and games. You got your tree-like structures that are buildings / drainage pipes / ladders on the sides of buildings that people can climb.
I think you're thinking of fire escapes.
Yeah, whatever. There you go. Fire escapes. No, I was thinking of the ladder that they climbed up inside of the meatpacking.
Oh,
I guess
yeah.
It's probably still part of a fire escape thing. But the other thing that the other reason I kind of don't like the way they sort of tweaked the rules of when and where and why the Predator does his things is like the Predator in this movie. I don't know if it's the way they shot the action, but he seems really stupid, like really, really stupid. And maybe it's just because this Predator, because again, spoiler. There are more than one, as also noted by the fact that in the first movie it blew up at the end. Maybe this is just the dumb Predator. Like, all of the other ones were hanging out on the ship at the end, and, like, the dumb one snuck out because he's like, I'm going to show my older brothers that I know how to hunt, and he ends up getting his arm cut off and then stabbed in the stomach with his blade thing or whatever. But, like, he's really stupid. Like, he has no strategy aside from the fact that he's like, oh no, on our little infrared thing, he's sneaking around behind you because he knows how that's a good place to attack. But this Predator's dumb. He's not really intimidating beyond the fact that he's tall and has blades and stuff.
Well, this Predator, while Stan Winston came back to do the effects and sort of modified them, it's still played by Kevin Peter Hall. As it just covered in more stuff that looks different. Not that you would notice, but...
Well, he's got a more articulate mouth thing.
Oh, there is a line that Danny Glover says that I'm not sure if I should repeat on this podcast, but let's just say there's some anatomical aspects to the Predator mouth, which are heavily mentioned in this and dwelled upon by the lens. The lens lingers on these certain mouth parts.
Yeah, I must have missed that line, but I know what you're talking about.
It's something a presidential nominee got in trouble for saying in a videotape. does that help?
Yeah, no, I gotcha. I think everyone, if they're watching this movie or if they remember, they get it. Yeah, aside from that, they added much more human eyeballs to the Predator, which didn't quite make it. So they're kind of Uncanny Valley fake weird.
It's a little strange. They also sort of increased the crustacean like aspects of him, so he's a little less of the undefined musculature around the mouth. There's more of like a I don't know how to describe it, like a plating or something. Like more exoskeletal than the original was. It doesn't bother me a whole lot. I think it's interesting, though, that this Predator has an array of weird toys, whereas the first one mainly just had two. And I don't know if that's, you know, sequelitis, where you just got to up the ante on the number of wacky weapons that you have, because it's not like they were making toys for this, for children. You know, there wasn't like a Nerf cannon launcher for your shoulder or anything. Or extendable lawn dart pikes or something.
Yeah, although, I mean, it sort of stands to reason. When you think about sort of the way the Predator does combat in general, you know, he's big on the hand-to-hand stuff, so he's got his wrist blades. The one that's really out of character, if you're sort of thinking about the way he fights, is his little cannon blaster thing, because you would think more hand-to-hand weaponry, like the spear and sort of the blade thing, would be in his repertoire. But it's not the kind of thing where you would expect him to, like, learn and develop new tools in the last like 10 years if they've been doing this for centuries. So that's a little odd. But one of the other things that I don't know if they intentionally changed from the first movie to this one, but they did, and it really, really irritates me, is that we see his infrared vision and all of the associated sounds of his infrared vision after he takes his mask off, which we don't see in the first movie to my recollection. So
yeah, he has a different form of vision. It's the all red and stuff.
Yeah, I thought his infrared vision was associated with his equipment, mm-hmm. and then when he took that off, he just had his flat red vision at the end of the first one. And in this one, not only does he have multiple forms of UV and infrared and all that other stupid stuff, which is cool, I like that, that he used those things in the meatpacking whatchahoozit there, he took his mask, well, they pulled his mask off for him, and then he still had his infrared vision, which I did not like. But I guess, you know, once you saw the close-up of the mask, you saw that it was just like a little mesh screen over his eyeballs, which I also don't remember from the first movie. So yeah, I didn't like that. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, well, I don't think you were supposed to see that it was just a little mesh screen. I think the mesh screen is more of a operational on-set use, and that, well, they just got a lot closer to it than they did in the first one.
But he looks out of like the neck area, because he's not even as tall as the prop was.
No. But when he's wearing the mask and walking around, he doesn't have to have the whole animatronic face on. You know?
Mm-hmm. But I thought he's still... I thought the way it's built, it's taller than him, and his human eyes are sort of looking out underneath the jaws of the thing.
I think you're thinking of the first alien design where it was more in the neck thing. But
I thought it was both, but maybe I am.
I think there are these small little holes that were in the cheekbone area, which were where he was supposed to be seeing out of or something. But it doesn't matter. I don't think that the mesh screen is on purpose as an actual production design element. I think that seeing that it was a simple screen is just an, you know, whatever. It's how they had to design the prop, and it wasn't like an intention. The infrared vision struck me as one of the many continuity problems in this. There are cuts in this where we go from him holding implements and they're not in the cloaking effect, and he is, and then it cuts to him and the implement being in the cloaking effect together. So, and most notably, when he goes to assault the voodoo gang in the Colombian drug lord apartment, condo, whatever, penthouse, the penthouse, when they have that fight, there's a cut where we go from an uncloaked spear to a cloaked spear, without any transition at all between the two, other than the camera cut. So it strikes me that no one was paying a super close amount of attention to the details in this, for a lot of these things, because we never even found out why things like the wrist blades or whatever would uncloak when they come out. And at least I had always assumed the cloaking effect had something to do with his helmet. Or some part of it, like, that helped obscure maybe his face or something. But there were aliens in the final scene, the Predators walking around, that didn't have any masks on but were using the cloaking effect. So it's not clear.
The guys at the end there and the stupid things, like, why are they cloaking in their own ship? This is theoretically like hunter camouflage. They wouldn't be turning that stuff on. Like this is one of the reasons I say this Predator is so stupid. And I guess now it applies to the ones at the end there. Like they were so like, how cool is it that we have the cloaking effect that it's like, he doesn't even need to hide or try and like be any sort of strategic hunter. He can literally just like walk around and like stand next to a tree in broad daylight in a cemetery because he's got his cloaking effect. And if you look like right at him, at like that kid did, you can totally sort of see him there, but he's just like, well, I'm just going to turn on my thing and I'm going to stand here. He's not like hiding. He's not attempting to be a hunter where he's, you know, up high or, you know, being strategic about his movements. He's just doing whatever he feels like doing, whenever he feels like doing it, just walking around next to people. He's just like, oh, you can't see me because I'm invisible, and all of the stuff on the roof there in the penthouse stuff and jumping around, and like, he's just hanging out next to people. Like, this is not the behavior that we were led to believe from the first movie, this like expert hunter who has his entire life built around, you know, being top of the food chain kind of person in a world of terrifying aliens, how he would conduct himself. And it's just like, he's just kind of a dummy, and I don't like it.
Well, the thing about this movie is that its central conceit is that he is, as Gary Busey says, on safari and hunting the lions and the tigers and the bears. Oh my.
It's a good line for the trailer.
Yes.
I did watch the trailer, by the way.
The trailer's absurd.
Mostly because trailer voice guy, but yeah.
Yeah. This Thanksgiving.
He's in town with a few days to kill.
Oh, God. I couldn't even say it without laughing.
It's a pun. See, it's yeah. That's totally your thing.
Did you notice that in that trailer, the coroner voice was replaced by somebody who was more intelligible because it was not a French actress? But
everyone's voice in this movie was replaced, I think. Like, all of this is... And not even that good ADR. It's just, it's all, the camera is like 50 yards away and we hear Danny Glover like whispering to himself as he gets out of the car, and the sound mix doesn't change no matter what camera angle it is. It's like, good Lord, guys. Did you not even bother recording sound on set, or was it all just so bad from all of the sirens and nonsense that you just had to re-record everything? The audio in this movie is really bad, and
yeah,
as anyone knows, bad audio makes movies feel so much worse.
Yeah. Well, I mean...
Also, this... Adam Baldwin.
Oh, God, Adam Baldwin. Ugh. So, let's just talk about the government. Let's just do it. Let's talk about the government, Dan.
We're talking about the fictional government in the movie, right? Not the real one?
Yeah, because the fictional government in the movie somehow is less competent than our real government, because they have a silver helicopter which is already dented at the start of the film. I don't know if you caught that, but I just, every time I watch that shot where it's just they have it fly over and descend, and it's just like, you guys couldn't buy a silver helicopter that didn't have a giant dent in the side of it? But they all come out of the thing and they're wearing basically, like, I don't know, yacht club attire, like
identical yacht club attire. Yeah, they're all wearing like khakis and a blue polo shirt tucked in, buttoned all the way to the top, and then just like a sort of like a members only style jacket over top,
and some wraparound sunglasses. And they're all white and blonde, mostly with Adam Baldwin being the exception, I guess. And then you got Gary Busey in a suit that is like five times too big for him.
Well, everyone's suit is too big for them in this movie. Danny Glover is wearing a suit like three sizes too large in all instances.
Oh, what gets me about what Danny Glover is wearing is that the pants are enormous. And most of the time he doesn't have a jacket on, so it doesn't balance it out at all.
Yeah,
so,
they're pleated. And the other thing is, it's 109 in Los Angeles and he's wearing wool.
Yeah.
It's a good look. Don't get me wrong. I'm a fan of wool, but like, it's not really appropriate for summertime in Los Angeles.
It's not a good look though, Dan, because it's up basically like almost up to his rib cage, and it's also far too wide. So most of the time, it's like billowing around behind him. It's just like, this is not flattering, especially when the camera's following him, and it just makes it look like he's an enormous butt. I know that's not the
well,
case.
You know, pleats were big in fake 1997.
Yeah, it wasn't. This was a. It was a bad attire choice. But back to the government, they don't make any sense at all in the film. They are seemingly there because they figured they wanted to have an advanced opponent to go up against the Predator, and the only way to do that is to have an opponent that knows the strengths and weaknesses of the Predator. And since nobody from the first film is making an appearance in this film, then you have to have some other intermediary force that can have that knowledge and convey it and use the knowledge to their advantage. And that turns out to be the government, who knows about the Predator from the first film because of reports from Arnold Schwarzenegger and Anna, who were rescued. Supposedly, that is what Gary Busey reveals later on. And that based on the sheer destructive power of the self-destruct weapon that the alien possessed, they have somehow figured out a way to track the alien, that he's in Los Angeles, and that he goes to this meatpacking plant, and that he is weak against cold stuff, and blah, 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 all this stuff. Now, the cold thing, you could say, oh, well, Arnold Schwarzenegger told him about the mud, and so that way you don't have to have some ridiculous scene, like in the movie Predators, where somebody has to figure out mud again. But in this one, you have to deal with, basically, the government not doing anything for the whole film other than obstructing Danny Glover, and then a final scene where Danny Glover happens to wander in on them, gets hit by a car in his car, and then taken from his car up a little ramp to a trailer. And Gary Busey explains everything before they have a scene from Aliens unfold, where they have the team of well-armed people who have the situation well in hand and have outsmarted an alien force, and they're all on separate video monitors, and they all have special weapons, and they're all going to go inside, and they have the upper hand, and they have a tracker for where the alien is inside of the building, and it could not be any more directly cribbed from the movie Aliens. You'd have to change Danny Glover's character's name to Ripley. I don't understand he even rips the little earpiece thing and microphone off of somebody and then talks into it and says, you know, get your people out of there. And it's just like, really? I wonder where someone would get that idea from. I certainly haven't seen that ever before recently, especially not in a movie that has any kind of an alien force inside of it. So it's a little depressing that the government exists purely to have this conflict of somebody who could be on equal footing with the Predator, which would build more tension than just some other stumbling person trying to figure out how to fight the Predator. It doesn't last very long because their plan had some holes, and everything falls apart just like in Aliens, and they need to be extracted, and Danny Glover comes into the rescue, and he starts shooting up stuff. And Gary Busey's the one who is last left alive, shot by a rocket. Oh no, he's dead. Not dead. And then he dies again with the side of beef. And that's it. That's the government's contribution to this movie. And then later on at the end of the film, the same ridiculous silver helicopter with a dent descends. and goes. Adam Baldwin gets out of there, goes up to Danny Glover, accosts him, and says something nonsensical about, you know, all the hard work they've been doing. And it's just like, you, what? Who cares? Like, this is ridiculous. The government plot in this film can be excised completely without losing a thing. I don't understand why it's even really in here other than being able to give you that information dump, which could happen through a variety of means from other sources.
Like all of the terrible news reports that are going on all the time.
Yeah. Like this, the ridiculous hardcore reporter,
Tony Pope.
Yeah. Tony Pope, screaming and shouting, where's the mayor? And he features prominently in the first two acts of this film as some sort of antagonistic news force amongst the many news reporting agencies that show up every single time something happens in the city, which is unbelievable. But he's featured prominently and even goes into one of the crime scenes and has a special camera that he's holding that nobody can see, a little handheld one, and records stuff that he smuggles out of there that the government guys don't get. And it's like you could have leveraged him as someone who had tracked where the predator might be going, had seen the distortion on video or something and caught it going into the meatpacking center. And then he can't actually do anything, but he has to tell Danny Glover, but he doesn't want to tell Danny Glover because he doesn't trust the police and doesn't think that they're going to do the right thing. There's a variety of ways that you could write something that
You can't do that because Tony Pope is a cartoonish, ridiculous character in and of himself. I think he's the most Verhoeven character in this whole thing. Like the tone of this movie is very sort of RoboCop, kind of just like all over the place. It's cartoonish and then like nonsensical, but then like you think it's sort of doing some of it on purpose, but a lot of it feels like it's not on purpose. Like the pacing of this movie, it has basically just one speed, which is way too fast all the time, never letting anything settle down ever. Like the only time it ever slows down is literally when the camera slows down for the slow-mo part where Gary Busey gets his head cut off, and like there's a little bit of slower paced stuff in the meatpacking building there, but this whole thing is so relentless. And like Danny Glover's job is to speed his car into a scene where there's some sort of thing has happened, slam on the brakes, come running out of the car, grab the first person next to him and go, "What happened?" And then keep running and sprint into some sort of crime scene and then ignore something over the radio that says, like, "Don't go in there because Gary Busey's on his way." Like, "All right, we didn't hear that. We're doing our own thing." And they go in and then they see stuff and then they get yelled at. Like, that happens like 3 times. And we don't care anytime because it doesn't seem real. Like, there are so many things in this movie that are bad. Like, it's not, you don't even know where to start. Like, there's the implementation stuff where I don't know if they like ran out of takes or whatever. But did you notice like when they hit Danny Glover's car with that truck and then he was like, quote unquote, unconscious when they like took his gun out of his belt or whatever when he was leaning up against the car, that he just like, he flopped back against the car like he was unconscious and they like took his gun out and then they're like, all right, they went to go grab him to like drag him inside. He just basically stood up and walked his way out. It's like, okay, this is,
yeah,
none of this looks real. I don't believe any of this. And then you've got bad writing and then you've got bad concepts and just like all of it is bad. And it makes me angry because there's so much stuff you could do with around the predator monster and they're just not doing it well.
It doesn't make me angry because I don't have, I guess my mind is so tainted by the things that have come after the first Predator movie and by the original Predator movie itself not exactly having lofty ideals that I don't exactly, I don't see this as a missed opportunity for them to get an Oscar, but I just don't think they're operating on that wavelength at all. And I think for this movie trying to be true to what it is, it mostly fails in that it tries to do too many things at once. So I can go along with any one of the ridiculous things they want to pick, but they don't pick any one of them and stick with it the whole time. So you get a smattering of ideas.
Yeah, this particular movie is more about government bureaucracy than it is about an alien in Los Angeles.
Well, it's weird because it's mostly the police angle of this and the bureaucracy side of this is mostly played like as if this was a New York cop procedural. Like, oh, you're stifling me and I can't do the thing that I need to do. And so-and-so's always in my way because of dumb reasons. And what's his face, who has been on lots of things, who plays the police head jerk guy. I don't even remember his name. He plays an outsized role in this, and I just don't know why. Curiously, Kent McCord is in here, and he's known for playing the father Jack Crichton on Farscape. You ever watch Farscape?
No, I don't know what that is.
The second I saw him, I said that. But anyway, it's all played like police procedural nonsense. And it's played in this really gritty way. Like, even our introduction to the police department is this gritty punk rockers and druggies and prostitutes and everything being booked in a booking room and the camera panning through.
Gotta do a big long one shot going through everybody, seeing all of the people fighting and pushing back against it. It's just so dumb.
Yeah, because it's lifted straight out of RoboCop, and it's played up to a cartoonish degree, where even the original source material for RoboCop is a cartoon. So this is just a cartoon with more people. And they keep pushing on this angle for a little bit at the start of the film, like with the drug war, the outside of the police precinct, which is the old stock exchange building, but it's covered by these barriers and graffiti, and the interior booking area, and the offices where people were just shouting at each other to try and get stuff done, and the smoky blinds and stuff. And you have all of that, but then it just all disappears, completely drops away from the film. And we only see it appear a couple of other times when Danny Glover gets some pushback from the higher ups because he's ruffled Gary Busey's feathers. And that's it. It plays no part in the third act. It plays no part in the end of the film. It has nothing to do with the resolution. It is strange to have that focus. And there's also the mention of teamwork because we get the addition of Bill Paxton to the team. And when Bill Paxton joins the team, he's a, you know, a cowboy, quote unquote. And it's like he gets reprimanded by Danny Glover for that. And it's just like, do you remember what you just did 3 minutes ago with that car and the
Yeah, but they
vests?
Did it as a team.
Yes, as a team. As a team, they were cowboys.
Yeah, they a team of cowboys. And then at the end, basically, one of his cowboy team members dies, and then it becomes immediately personal, and he throws caution to the wind and the law to the wind, and just goes after this alien with a vengeance for revenge. Even after he finds out that it's a crazy alien from another planet, he's like, I don't care, man. He killed my buddy. I'm going after him one-on-one. I'm going to take him down. It's like, well...
Well, he also accepts that it's a crazy alien from another planet pretty easily. but because there have been some weird things up until that point in the film, but he's just like, okay, fine.
Yeah, but he's had at least two scenes where he hears something behind him and he whips around and pulls his gun out and starts pointing it in every direction because he can't see the actual alien. He's just trying to figure out where it is, and then can't see anything, so puts it away. Like, my God, the scene in the cemetery is so poorly shot. It's just like, go wide-eyed crazy and whip your gun left, right, and center, and we're going to do some weird sound effects, and then there's nothing there. And it's like, good Lord. Like, that particular scene is almost B-movie status, except for the fact that Danny Glover's in it. But goodness, that was bad.
Also, I have no idea how they buried him so fast. Did that occur to you when
no,
you were watching it?
No, it did not. It was like 2 hours.
Yeah, they're just, not only did they bury him fast, they found him off screen, knew that it was him and that he died, even though presumably his head is missing. And he was inside of a special crime scene area where no one should have been or was observing or had any real chance of going back in anytime soon. So who knows how long that was supposed to take. So he was there for several hours, 2 days maybe, dead, and then we just cut back to that. And it's just like we get that scene with Jack Crichton where he's just like, oh, it's personal, and then the cemetery. He's just like, how much time has elapsed? I have no idea, because it doesn't really play a part in anything at all.
No, you know, it's weird though, because like you said, they are doing a ton of different things, but at the same time, they do those things, like they do each of those things like 3 or 4 times. Like they're not subtle about any of this. Like the disobeying orders, you've got the scenes where the Predator is slaughtering bad guys, all of Danny Glover's like disobeying orders and stuff. Like he does the same stuff over and over again, and then you've got the voodoo guys who were the gang moving in against the Colombian guys. You've got the fact that the Predator was at the cemetery, I guess, because like he saw Danny Glover do his awesome thing in the opening scene. He's like, wow, this guy must be one of the best lions down here to hunt or whatever, so I'm going to follow him around. But then he does the thing where he taunts him by hanging his dead friend's necklace from the tree, which is like, that seems a bit peculiar for the Predator that we knew from the first movie. Like, if he was going to set a trap, maybe, because he's a hunter and he sets traps and stuff. But this is just, like, taunting for the sake of taunting. Like, haha, look at me, I killed your friend. Like, that's not what this thing does. And then you've got your government thing. You've got your lifted from alien stuff. You've got your chasing up and down the sides of the building, and then the old lady with the, of course you have to have a scene where they fix a wound where he screams a lot, which I always remember, and I always like the part where he makes the blue goop out of the drywall with his syrupy stuff and then pastes it on himself with his little expandable dish thing. I always thought that was cool. But that scene, if it needed to be there at all, it could have been 5 seconds instead of minutes.
Well, I just didn't need the old lady. But, you know, the old lady adds a comedy element, so it kind of turns this into a... It puts it back in sort of that Verhoeven-esque vibe, where there's...
I would have found her funnier if they didn't ADR her, too.
Well, you know.
All the great ADR. Everything in this movie is ADR.
I think somebody had a bad day on set with a microphone, and then they just repeated that day for the rest of filming. But the...
They forgot to hit record on their call recorder for 30 days straight or whatever.
Oh, dear. What a mess. Oh, they were recording the laptop audio the whole entire time. No, but...
they had the wrong mic input set to their Nagra recorder the whole time.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's just like 80 hours of the boom operator breathing heavily.
You're like, well, oh, we've got some Predator breath effects. But
God, and did you notice how formulaic all of that was? Like, every time they would cut to infrared view, you would see his little audio repeat back sensor, you would hear him play back an audio clip, and then you would hear his little sound or whatever. Like, every single time they did the exact same series of sound effects. And it's like, well, in the first one, the Predator was like studying the people, and they would make a funny sound or make a phrase, and he would record that and play that back. Like, in this one, it's just like he's just got like a running recorder 24 hours a day, and like it's constantly playing back in his headphones, just so like it's like his white noise machine is just the sounds of people that he's hunting. It's really weird.
It's strange because there is not a tremendous amount of discretion as to when he decides to record things. I don't really understand why that is. And it could be used effectively in some cases had they edited down the number of times that they chose to do it. I think it's just done quite a bit and seemingly without any sort of purpose. Because we also never get a clear understanding of how much of the English language and of, let's just say, American cities the Predator understands, because he must understand enough that he can hunt and track Danny Glover across town, and that he can pursue Danny Glover and understand that Danny Glover has a team that he wants to take down and can also therefore track that team into a subway tunnel system. So it requires some more sophisticated intelligence than the first Predator had demonstrated, because it seemed like in the first movie, that Predator was learning as he was hunting. And in this one, it doesn't seem like he's learning as he's hunting so much, because he seems to know an awful lot about Los Angeles.
Well, yeah, they follow his patterns or whatever, but I don't know. I think an equally likely situation would be that he is really just dumb, and he just turns on his cloaking, and he's literally walking behind Danny Glover the entire time, and Danny Glover just can't see him. Like,
that can't be the explanation, because he goes off and he does other things, and then he goes back to Danny Glover.
Yeah, they probably intended to insinuate that he was smart and he had these patterns and stuff. I just didn't see it in the character. So I'm more inclined to think like, no, he's just walking behind you the whole time. You just can't see him.
No,
from rooftop to rooftop.
I just think they were really inconsistent with how they chose to do this, and that
they're inconsistent with everything. Like, there are times where he jumps like three stories up and or down and like lands in guys and kills them and then jumps back up to the roof, and then they're like in the meatpacking facility, like he's going like hand-to-hand combat with Danny Glover, and he can't even like get out of the way of like a gunshot or anything. He's just like, oh no, I had no idea that was coming, and now I'm gonna get shot a bunch and fall down. It's like he was asleep, or maybe because he didn't get his meat that day, that he was really like weak and kind of had low blood sugar or something. But I don't know, it made me sad.
Well, I noticed how you said get out of the way of that, but the kind of weapon that he was using, you wouldn't really get out of the way of. But that brings up another point, in that he gets out of the way of all of the other weapons that are in the film, except for except for the one time that Danny Glover is shooting him in the meatpacking facility, he basically is unscathed by every other weapon that's here. In the first film, the Marines had wounded the Predator when he was out and about. Even though they were no match for the Predator, they'd still landed some shots on him because they were firing so many bullets. And in this one, they're firing probably as many bullets in the various scenes total and hitting nothing. So it is a little preposterous. Like, there are scenes where they're just straight up shooting at him. And you see some ricochets and, like, sparks and stuff as if it were bouncing off of armor. But he's not that armored, particularly in his torso.
Yeah, he's got maybe some chest stuff, but he's basically mostly got a mask and then, like, his wrist thing. By the way, pro tip, in case anyone ever sets the countdown timer for a nuclear bomb near you, just cut that bomb in half and it won't blow up.
Yes, that's how payloads work.
That's totally how payloads work and how all sorts of explosives work. Cut them in half. That renders them useless.
I mean, and that just goes hand in hand, pun intended, with what Gary Busey had. He had the information dump of how a self-destruct mechanism is how this had worked in the first film. So then the entire time you're thinking, oh, well, if he gets the upper hand, then he can use the self-destruct mechanism. And of course, Danny Glover does get the upper hand in a very literal sense. And the Predator goes to use the self-destruct mechanism. It seems awfully soon to do that.
Yeah, he's hanging off the building and he's like, I see this as an opportunity where I can kill you. And just killing you means I'm going to win because, haha, this is all just a battle. So I'm hanging on to you and I'm going to hit self-destruct and blow you up. But, like, no, in the first one, it was literally dying, trapped under a tree, and he was about to get his head smashed in, and just like as a last ditch effort, even though he was going to die, he was going to blow up Arnold Schwarzenegger at the same time. In this one, if he fell off that building, I didn't see him dying because he jumped off a building equally as high earlier when he killed the voodoo guy. So, like, what are you doing? You just want to, like, use the LED thing on his wrist again and you couldn't come up with a better place to put it.
Well, I think they wanted to show the audience that it was off the table. They wanted to show everyone that wasn't going to be the outcome of this film, and it wasn't. However, there are other ways to do that. It's a little strange that he slices it in half, but okay, fine. And then at least you're not thinking that that's going to happen at the end of the film, the entire rest of the film, because it keeps going on after that. Not much longer, but enough. And there are other ways of going about negating that sort of thing. And you certainly didn't have to have Gary Busey explain the countdown timer to him, because if there's anything that anyone can know about the countdown timer, it's that Arnold Schwarzenegger could figure out the countdown timer in the matter of seconds and quickly jump behind a log. So it's not like it takes a tremendous amount of brain power either for the character in the film or for the audience at large. So dwelling on it enough to make it that plot point is a questionable use of time and resources. And then you gotta sit there and be like, so he cut a bomb in half and I guess it just kind of split in two and nothing bad happened. Okay. Otherwise it would have leveled several city blocks, but it was cut in half. So, you know, like you cut a laptop battery in half. Let's, I mean, it's not a good thing.
Yeah, they should remake in the remake, which I believe they are making. He should pull a Samsung phone out of his wrist and break it in half and throw it to somebody.
Too soon. and the thing though about the inconsistencies that we've been bringing up this whole entire time is that everything is inconsistent, and that everything is all over the place, and that any one of these things you could, if tasked with, write a better angle for just that one thing being prominent in the film. Like, if you were tasked with just writing this to be a movie about the police force featuring Danny Glover and the bureaucracy of it versus the Predator, then you could do that. This film doesn't do that. This film just has it in there for the first act and a half. And you could even make it about specifically the team dynamics that Danny Glover has. They kind of stop that by the end of the second act too, because the team's dead except for Leona, who was played by Maria Conchita Alonso, and that's because she was pregnant. And we get that infrared.
Right, which was incredibly convenient when it needed to be there, but there's no addressing it at any other point.
No, because these characters don't have any personal lives outside of work that we know of, so why it's in the film doesn't make a lot of sense, other than they just didn't want to kill her, I guess. But she goes off to the hospital, and we don't see her again. Bill Paxton is dead and despined, and we had Detective Archuleta, Ruben Blades' character, who died very early in the film, and so there's no one left on the team, and there's no scene with the Robert Davi, the deputy police chief, who is busting his butt the whole entire time. He doesn't show back up at any point. There wasn't a scene with the captain.
By the way, speaking of that scene, busting his butt in the beginning there, did you happen to notice, again, like, everything about this, the implementation, how bad it was? Like, did you see his entrance when, like, the camera just sort of pans over and he's just sort of standing there? And he's like, 1, 2, 3. He starts to take a step forward. Get over here, Eric. Yeah. I'm going to yell at you. He's like, why are you standing right there inside of the police court and you're just waiting for your cue? I can literally see you over his shoulder waiting for your cue. This is like the worst staging I've ever seen. Like,
I got some worse staging for you.
You talk about the one where they do the really slow pan and then suddenly Danny Glover's face appears out of the left side of the frame.
No, I was going to go with when they're in the truck and Danny Glover decides he's going to go make his rescue attempt, and he's stopped by the guy, and he goes to choke him to get him out of the way. he barely touches his neck. And you can see it on film, barely touching his neck. And the guy who's being choked, air quotes, is making the most affected, like, gravelly, like, I'm being choked voice that he could possibly make. And it is so inconsistent with what you're seeing on film that it's just like, is he just doing this, like, this is what you would do if you were trying to, like, use up a sick day or something and you wanted to play hooky. Like, there is,
even after he does that, they cut back again, you see his hand on the neck and it's like 4 inches away, like his fingertips are barely touching the guy's neck and he's being pushed back up against the wall. And it's like, did you guys shoot the rehearsal or something? Is this, what did something bad happen to the actual take of this scene?
Yeah, like, he's not Darth Vader. Like, actually have him choke him. And if Danny Glover was, like, being timid or careful or something like that, then a good director would say, no, Danny Glover, that man is worth no money to us at all. Just please choke him. It'll be fine. We'll pay for whatever it is. Like, he doesn't even need to choke him. He just needs to have his hand, like, on his actual throat. Like, it doesn't even happen. And
grab him by the shirt or whatever and shove him up against the wall or something. But, like, that, and then again, the scene earlier where he's, like, pretending to be unconscious, like, they're in no way is a believable body motion by any character in those scenes. And it's just like, what am I watching? Like, I don't understand or believe any of this. And that is bad.
Yeah.
Also, why did the Predator go to the top of the building with Paxton's spine and skull and, like, hold it up to the lightning and go, like, yeah, look at me. Like, why are you celebrating? You're not... That's not who you are. That's not what we've come to know you are as a character.
You keep focusing on this as if it was the same guy from the first one, but it isn't, no, Dan.
I know, but, like, the thing that is good about Predator and the Predator series is this sort of, like, credo that this planet of Spartan warriors lives by, and, like, the reason they do these things is because, like, that's who they are. That's their culture of things. And everything that strays away from that is demonstrably bad and is worse for the plot. Like, if they were to stick with that sort of, like, warriors mentality and this sort of, like, hunter mentality through all of it, that should have informed most of their decisions and they would have been much better off for it. But every time they stray away from it, it's like, what are you doing? This is terrible and makes no sense.
Yeah, well, I could understand wanting to celebrate his kill a little and his victory over his opponent's team if it wound up making any sort of lasting effect in this, if it was some component that this particular Predator always celebrated kills or something. But
I mean,
instead,
it's just got to be that he's got to show off to his big brothers back at the ship. That's why he polished the other skull real nice and hung it on the wall, so his big brother would see it and go like, not bad, Mikey. You got a nice shiny one there. Look at, he's got all his teeth too.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing about that scene is the Eastern Building is not a meatpacking plant. The geography of the meatpacking plant, apartment building, and the Eastern Building doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, you were talking about some of the sets. I have a question about one of the sets that I know I've seen before, and I was wondering if you know which one it was. The one where Danny Glover grabs Gary Busey and shoves him up against the wall and says, like, he killed my friend, where it's that, like, a marble staircase that comes down on both sides of the other staircase.
I don't know exactly what that is.
I've seen that in dozens of movies.
There's a very good reason for that, and it's probably because it's in Los Angeles, but I couldn't name that specific spot off the top of my head, but I can tell you with some certainty that the Eastern Building is not a location for a meatpacking plant. So when Danny Glover chases after the Predator with his car and drives through that building down to the other alley area and then through that poorly constructed fence and into that area where he's taken out by the truck, and then walked from his car to the trailer where he does all of the walking, but just kind of hunches over as if he were being carried. And when he gets to that trailer, that's the same area as the Eastern Building. Like they pan up to there and it's, you know, he's doing the lightning stuff and all that shenanigans and nonsense. And then they cut to the, what was it, Red Wing meatpacking something next to the trailer. It's like, did they drive over there? And the answer is no, they didn't drive over there, because when Danny Glover goes back outside of the trailer, his car is next to the trailer where it was before, and he gets his weapons and goes back over there. So it's just like, what geography is this? And then when they go through the whole meatpacking thing, up the many floors of the meatpacking thing, which are kind of, I guess, the Eastern Building, and then over to the apartment building. It's just like, none of this makes any sense. Also, the whole entire reason why they suspected the meatpacking plant was because of bovine blood with steroids. Oh, the meatpacking district. That's where I lost Gary Busey.
It's a good thing there's only one meatpacking or meat freezer building in the entire district there.
Yeah, it's very neat and tidy for the city of Los Angeles, I suppose.
Especially because it's like next to a parking deck where they can park their completely inconspicuous government semi-trailer.
Yeah, also it's a good thing that they hadn't outlawed steroids and RBSTs and stuff, and that this wasn't all natural milk. It was a different era back then, so they could use it for tracking.
If the Predator was eating organic beef, they would have no leads.
No. Well, no, I'm sure they'd have some ridiculous scene where they'd be like, we can track the kind of grass that the cow used to eat.
Oh, totally.
Because the science in the coroner medical examiner office scene is bad. Not just like a little off or a stretch. You know, like sometimes, you know, they'll put something in a centrifuge and they'll be like, we have his DNA. Like, you know how that happens sometimes? The reality of the situation is that it takes weeks, if not months, if not years, to process DNA for evidence for certain cases. In this particular instance, she takes a metal hook thing and then puts it into a spectral analyzer thingamajig and then says, none of this is on the periodic table.
No, she puts it into a scanning electron microscope and then it suddenly spits out all of the chemistry of the material. It's like, what? That's not how any of that works.
No, it is... It is so weird, and I don't understand what it's supposed to convey to the audience. It's like, oh no, it's something from another world. It's like, well, duh, like we're already on that page, guys. Let's keep going. Like, what did we need the scene for?
And yeah, that's the rule, right? Don't have a scene where the audience already knows more than the characters. That's not good.
Yeah, because the whole thing, like, if it's supposed to be a revelation that it's something from another world, then you need to do a better job than this, and then you'd also lose your Gary Busey scenes, because you don't need to have someone say it's an alien twice. And they do, and I don't understand the necessity for that. And it's not like the medical coroner is played by the medical examiner is played by some sort of big name person who's making a cameo, like in the instance of Lawrence Fishburne, who I described earlier. Like in this particular instance, it's a French actress, Lillian Chauvin, who I could have sworn was so familiar, and I looked her up, and she was on Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and she was Vedic Yassam. Did you know that, Dan?
No, I didn't know that.
You didn't watch Rocks and Shoals? So anyway, she looks familiar to me, but she's not like a big name, so it's like, why did... I mean, it's nice that you kept her employed, I guess, but like none of this needs to be in the film.
No, especially because like they started to lead us to believe maybe that Danny Glover was going to be the first to catch on, or the smart guy who goes like, okay, maybe this is out of this world. Because when he sees in that opening sort of Colombian drug lord scene, when the guy like tries to shoot the predator and he thinks he's shooting at him and he shoots him off the building or whatever, when he flips around and he like sort of sees the cloaking outline of him, of the predator on the building above, he sort of like shakes his head like, my eyes must be deceiving me or something, and then the predator disappears. And then like you think from that, like maybe he's gonna get like, whoa, I just saw something and I don't know how to explain it, rather than just like, I must have been like not seeing anything at all, because like he doesn't learn anything from that really odd occurrence. He just goes about his day like, la-di-da, I guess I didn't actually see a weird cloaking alien on top of the building. I just gonna have to go find all these other clues before I finally believe it. And then once he finally does get the evidence from Gary Busey, he's like, oh yeah, totally, it's an alien, I get it, sure.
Yeah, and the length of time that these things are running in parallel in this film is not good, because the whole entire time the audience knows, like you and I both mentioned, the audience knows what's up, and the characters don't, and we're waiting for them to figure it out, and it's taking a really long time. And that when Danny Glover figures it out, he's not really figuring it out as much as he's being told it. So again, it's not ingenuity on his part that causes the story to move forwards. He just is propelled from scene to scene where someone talks to him. And I don't appreciate that very much.
No, he's just the last one to die, basically. And that's why he is the main character.
Yeah. It's a little troubling that he's not depicted as a more investigative detective. Like his skills as an investigator are not on display in the film, even though technically that would be a strength of his that he could display, but it's absent. And that
because his boss says like he's got commendations to counteract all of these terrible things that you're saying about him, but he's just like, welcome to the war zone, guy, everything down here is crazy and we're fighting for our lives. Like his character doesn't ever suggest that he is anything smarter than just a guy who can improvise and run real fast and shoot pretty well.
Yeah, his character also has no other dimensions to it, because the only characters he really deeply cares about are his team, and his team are all work people, and he doesn't seem to know anything about their personal lives, because he also didn't know that Leona was pregnant. And we don't know anything about about Glover's personal life, Lieutenant Mike R. Harrigan. We know absolutely nothing. Like, the only scene where he's off the clock inside of that bar, he's getting a briefing from Bill Paxton, and that's it. You know, so the rest of the time is he married? Did he used to be married, but the strain of the job was too much? Like something tells me that's something that these writers could have easily scribbled out in 2 minutes. But like nothing really exists outside of this. And now in the first film, that's forgivable. Like we don't need to know all the details about Dutch. About Arnold Schwarzenegger's
character. They're soldiers on the job. They're not going to have a moment where they sit around and talk about, you know, when I get back home, I'm going to see my lady, and we don't need that.
Yeah, no, and the span of time that the movie takes place over is also completely different. Because in that one, it's an operation that takes a few days from their initial insurgence to the rescue and well, rescue. Most of them are dead. But that is totally believable because they also know each other, so they don't have a reason to small talk with each other, and they also are on a military mission where they wouldn't be chit-chatting. But we're watching Danny Glover live his life for X number of days, and all of the hardships that he goes through as a normal human being in Los Angeles, and all of them center specifically just on this case and his work team, which is it just leads more to the one dimensionality of him as a main character, which is a little disappointing.
Very disappointing. This movie is doing as much as like Bad Boys 2, which is why Bad Boys 2 is like 2 hours and 45 minutes. I'm really glad this movie isn't 2 hours and 45 minutes, but they probably need that much time to sort of flesh out everything about the characters and the story that they're trying to do here. But
they have a Haitian gangs instead of King Willie's voodoo gang.
Right, Jamaicans or whatever. And did I see that the director was Jamaican too or something?
He is, I believe, an Australian born in Jamaica? I can't remember the details.
Born in Jamaica, yeah. I didn't see the Australian part, but I believe it.
Yeah, and this is written by Jim and John Thomas, who wrote the first one. And also get a characters created by Jim and John Thomas credit, which I find hilarious because it's like, of course you did, guys. Like, usually you see that like in the RoboCop sequels or something like that, where it's like, based on characters created by blah, 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 because the writers didn't return. But in this one, if you have the writers return, then I don't know why you say that. So
they probably got a bigger deal on sort of franchise rights and, all of the various properties that came out of this since they came up with The Predator itself, which again is the only thing interesting about these movies thus far, is the actual alien. And in this movie they didn't even use him very well, so hopefully this, whatever this stupid thing is they're making in 2018, actually sort of respects the alien and builds a reasonable world around it.
Well, you also forgot the other thing that returned. Do you know what that is?
The score.
Yeah, literally exactly the score.
I was going to ask you, did they use the same songs?
I don't even think they changed a note. Like, Alan Silvestri seems to have looked at his score for Predator and been like, yep, that was good. it over again.
Because, yeah, once the end credits popped up, I'm like, this is the same song, isn't it? This isn't even, they didn't even like try and riff off the theme. This is the same thing.
Yeah, well, there's no long tail Sally in this one, but it's really an interesting choice to not diverge at all, especially when you're changing the environment so drastically and the context of the hunting grounds, as it were, from the first one. To just repeat the original seems peculiar.
Yeah, but I just had a look at the IMDb page for the next one, and I got a little excited. You know why I got excited?
Shane Black. Yeah, I saw that on the Wikipedia page for Predators. There's a section on sequels, and I'm like, no. But but in the sequels section, there's a thing about how Shane Black is working on the next one, and it will probably not be an immediate thing that carries on the grand tradition of Predators. And
it says on IMDb a sequel to the 1987 film, so I'd be totally fine if they ignored all the movies except the first one. But I like Shane Black. He's a good writer too, who's writing the screenplay with Fred Decker. I don't know who Fred Decker is. I feel like I know that name, but I don't know who Fred Decker is. Wrote Star Trek Enterprise, some stuff.
Your favorite
RoboCop
show.
RoboCop 3.
Not RoboCop 3.
He directed RoboCop 3 also.
Oh, God. Have you seen RoboCop 3?
No, hopefully he wrote the first draft and then Shane Black took it over, and they're just credited like that because that's how the WGA works.
No, I want to make you watch RoboCop 3 one of these days.
I don't want to do it.
There are ninja robots in it, Dan.
ninja robots, like they have katanas and do flips and stuff.
Yep.
Oh, speaking of katanas, how'd you like that part of Predators?
Do we need to say spoiler alert at this point?
No, that movie's terrible. But okay. Like,
if anyone even remotely cares about this, then stop listening for a couple seconds, because I'm gonna say something mean, and that I don't appreciate what they did with that character and where they had him do the most stereotypical katana fight you've ever seen in any movie, where it's like, here's a field of long, tall grass, and it's gently blowing in the breeze, and now he's got his katana that he found, and it's very old, and he's going to use it against his opponent, and his opponent is going to fight honorably with his claw things, and then they run past each other and slash, and run past each other and slash, and oh no, who killed who? And you don't know because the shot doesn't reveal it, because they slowly fall over differently at staggered times. And then you get a shot of them from above because they're both dead. And it's just like effing, bleeping, all the expletives. Like, I was so angry when I saw that. It didn't surprise me because I knew when he found the katana in the ship that they were in that he would use it. Because there's no other reason to put anything in that film. I just knew it was going to wind up being some ridiculous thing. And, of course, they also tried to harken back to Billy in the original film.
That's what I was going to say. So there are two things about that are things that they tried to do admirably. So they tried to harken back to Billy, which is cool because, you know, it's a reference, whatever. He should have been the one to die, just like Billy did. He should have, like, just made easy work of him. But the other thing is, like, again, this whole like honorable fight thing, it's a thing that should be part of the Predator's world and their repertoire. Like, they're all about the honorable fight to a certain extent, so I think that part was a reasonable thing to do. But all of the whole stereotypical katana fight in the tall grass and like they both fall down at the same time, that is just completely stupid. And, you know, both of those things where I say like it's a good idea that they tried to do those, it would have been a good idea to try to do those like 20 years ago before they were both completely played out, because everyone's seen it like 100 times, so you know exactly what's going to happen. But I mean, maybe if they tried to do the honorable fight thing and the Predator just tore through him in like, you know, a half second, just killed him, he was like, well, you're terrible at this because we brought you all here together to work together as a team because you can't beat us one-on-one, then that would have been a little bit more interesting, but still not good.
I hate that movie. Now, back to this movie.
Topher Grace.
Topher Grace, God.
Poisonous plants and stuff. Everything on this planet wants to kill us. I feel like that's a line in that movie.
Probably was. Can't remember. But at least he knew the species or something and the kind of thing, and then he put it on the pocket knife, and then I swear to God, Dad, we weren't even like, what was that, 6 minutes into the film when that happens, and I'm just like,
Doesn't he do the thing where like somebody turns around and he does the like he puts his chin down and then like makes evil eyes at somebody like he's sneaking up behind him? It's like, okay, come on.
I mean, that little blade scene on, it's just like, okay, so when's he going to cut one of them to get an advantage over everyone else and to kill somebody? And sure enough, it happens eventually, but because you can't set up something like that and then not have it pay off. And he wasn't going to use it on a Predator because it's a pocket knife. And
I thought it was like a pocket scalpel because he was a doctor.
No, but and then there's the whole thing of like, I don't know. Adrian Brody's Batman voice. I don't know why he's here. He doesn't fit. And it's like, of course he fits. Because you're all murderers. And he's also a murderer. That goes into a whole other thing about like how I don't understand the abduction process for that and the research that went into happened there.
Adrian Brody's signature weapon is an automatic shotgun, which is terrible thing that nobody would ever carry. Terrible.
Well, that movie is not by anybody who actually gives a crap. It's by an awful, 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 awful team of people who just have fantasies about how cool and bad bleeping bleep it would be if bleepity bleep happened, and oh my god, man, can you believe it? Like, that is basically how I would summarize that movie. In Predator 2, because I would like to diverge back to this, in Predator 2, it's not so much about like the total total badness of anything, any particular thing. Like it's just a mess of elements. So I actually, I'm going to shock you with this revelation. I actually kind of still like the movie Predator 2 because it is a good bad movie. To borrow the scale from the Flophouse podcast, I would say that this is a good bad movie because it is a bad movie. It is legitimately a bad movie on almost every conceivable level that you could measure it on. It is not good, and it goes through all kinds of levels, from the writing to the execution of that writing and the acting in some scenes to the directorial choices, the staging, the effects are spotty. even though there were many that were sophisticated for the era and were certainly bigger things to tackle than the first film, so they certainly stepped it up there, but they still made some weird mistakes and choices where, like, the predators walking through the fog at the end of the film,
they just don't have legs.
They have kneecaps. Yeah. They have really dark kneecaps and hovering over white nothingness.
Well, they didn't invent deep compositing until a little bit later, so they couldn't figure that one out yet.
You didn't even need deep compositing. It really, that bothers me. And I know it's hard to do because it was all optical compositing for that. I know it is difficult, and I'm being a jerk for making fun of them in 1990 for what they were able to do without having sophisticated, you know, transparency tools available to them.
We should ask the fellow in our chat room how they actually did it. By the way, while you're in the chat room, click on that link that I just put in there. That is a poster for this movie that should tell you everything you need to know about the way they steered off course in this movie. It's him standing up on top of some sort of Gotham-esque protrusion from a tall building, holding a skull and spine, and just like, yeah, look at me, I'm a predator.
I feel like this should be on the side of someone's van.
somebody probably painted it on the side of their van as like fan fiction from the first movie, and they're like, ooh, that's awesome.
This is an airbrush disaster.
Also, that spine looks a little short.
Well, forget that spine. What is going on with the anatomy of the predator?
He's like doing the limbo. Actually, it looks like he's about to fall over backwards. Yes. Off the side of the building.
Look at his ankle and his knee. That doesn't make any sense. But anyway, that is absurd. Thank you for sharing. We'll put that in the show notes for the listeners.
It's on IMDb. It's just like the third image on the movie. It's just great.
So frustrating. Even with the tools that were available to them, I have to think that it would have theoretically been a better choice, at least, to not frame it at the knees like that. It could have been something where they were like, you know what, it's going to look amazing, and we'll talk the director into it. But the director should have shot coverage because the way it looks is awful because there are just these little black stubs that are hanging over a completely white fog. It doesn't make any sense.
And again, I wonder if they just did not plan to do that because, like I said earlier, there's literally no reason for them to go into cloaking mode inside their ship like this. Like, there's no reason they had to have like the Field of Dreams ending where the predators walk off into the cornfield and fade into nothing. Like, you're on your ship. You're not hunting. You don't need to be cloaking. You toss him his little like, all right, we respect you as a hunter pistol. Now get off our ship because we're going to fly away. Like, do you need to be invisible to fly the ship? Like, is that part of how this works? No, it's not. Stop doing that.
No, see, I like that they were cloaked to approach him.
Yeah, that works.
Yeah, I don't like that they cloaked to leave, because, like you said, that doesn't make any sense. They're flying their own ship. Like, or are they supposed to not see one another or something? Or, I mean, I have to assume that they can see each other through their cloaking devices, but it is a distraction. Now the gun he throws him at the end when he's like, here, you can have a trophy, and it's conveniently dated with
sure.
1715 on the side of it. And I don't know about you, but I don't I don't etch the date that I get a lot of things into the sides of other things, and along with my name. But, you know, maybe it was, like, really popular in 1715, and we've just never really heard about it since then. But it was an interesting choice. And so he gets some miscellaneous gun and needs to jump out of there. And then there's the compositing that doesn't align at all for the ship leaving the tunnel. Did you notice that? The fire going through the tunnel and stuff that doesn't match up with the perspective of the camera move that happens. Anyway.
I might have been looking at my hands at that point.
Because you were so mortified about them cloaking. Why did they cloak? It's their own ship.
He's going to jump behind a thing. There's going to be a giant fireball. He's not going to die. He's going to come walking out covered in dirt. There's going to be that weird fire trail because apparently the ship didn't take off. Just sort of dragged through the dirt for like 200 yards before it flew away. Whatever.
It doesn't make a tremendous amount of sense to me that... Because it raises a lot of questions, because there's modern graffiti inside of that tunnel.
Yeah. Just curse words, mostly. And I think they actually reused the weird props that were spray-painted that they had outside their fake police station. They just put them inside the tunnel.
Yeah, so they had graffiti all over the place in there. So somebody's recently been in there. It's not some secluded region of the underworld of Los Angeles that no one's accessed.
Also, they're below grade, apparently. They parked below the elevator shaft of a building and then cut a little tiny hole because that's how they want to sneak in, because they want to be real sneaky.
Yeah. It doesn't really make... Not only does it not make a tremendous amount of sense, but it also doesn't stand up to the in-universe logic of this, because, like I said, there's graffiti that's modern. They were in a tunnel where people were at least spray-painting things. And the tunnel wasn't some easily accessible thing. Like, they blasted off out of there, so they must have been down there for some time, one would assume. Because it's not like there's a gentle way to park that underneath the structure, and then, you know, you only, like, peel off out of there when you're leaving. Unless they had the whole thing of them entering the tunnel and then all the predators got out with little brooms and then just, like, cleaned up the trail when they got in.
Put out all the brush fires that led into it.
Yeah, and, like, I don't know why that was a necessary plot point. Also, with the ship, it could have been very easy to just have it be some cloaked ship in some area of town. You know, like Star Trek 4. You know, they got the cloaked bird of prey.
Well, LA doesn't have a central park big enough to sort of hide it, the whole thing.
Oh, they do too. You can park in Griffith Park.
Yeah, I was going to say, they should have landed it on top of Griffith Observatory, just had it been invisible the whole time.
Well, according to the geography of this film, nothing exists outside of downtown Los Angeles, which is
sure.
It's just an interesting choice to make. As Todd mentions in the chat room, the weird lights and stuff, they basically have a bunch of lights that are all strung up on a thing parallel to one another that they elevate on some rigging, and then they composite that fireball on top of it, and it's a bad shot. That's the shot I don't like. But as far as this ship thing is concerned, like, it doesn't add up in universe reasons for why it is down there. And in the first film, we saw a ship fly by and drop off a pod thing, you know, something that descends to Earth. And so in this one, the audience had assumed up until the end that this predator had also found its way to the city, you know, predator in the big city. But it didn't actually happen that way, because it's like, no, there are what, like, 8 predators hanging out in a ship underneath, just like, I don't know, you guys want to play solitaire again? Like, they don't feature into the story or plot or anything. They're just hanging out.
The younger brother, dumb one, is on safari in downtown Los Angeles killing people, while the rest of the predators are on a surfing safari in Santa Monica.
Well, joke's on them. The waves aren't very good in Santa Monica.
What? Where are there good waves? You got to go up to Malibu for that?
You got to go north or south.
Hmm. Okay.
Basically, LA itself, not amazing. I have been told, but there are a lot of people who like to take their boards out in the morning, and they're like, yeah, bro, it's the way I gotta start my day. Like, I check the surf report, and I go out on the waves, man. And they're, those are the people who live in Venice, and they're garbage people, and I don't like them. But there's...
Disclaimer, not all Venice people are garbage people.
No, that's not true. Of course it isn't. And they're just people who want to pay a ton of money so that they can't have parking. So they
that's literally everyone who lives in Los Angeles.
No, I have parking. But they still pay a lot of money. But there are people who like to live near the beach so that they can go catch some early morning surf. And that mostly consists of sitting on a board in water that's barely moving. But kudos to them.
I would enjoy having a backyard of a beach in the ocean, even if I didn't really surf.
Have you seen how close the sewage plants are to our coastline in Southern California?
Yeah.
I mean, supposedly there are these big pipelines that carry everything really far out to sea, and it's not a concern, except if it's rained recently, and then there's always an advisory not to enter the water because all of the concrete channels and canals and stuff have been flushed out of whatever detritus and human scum has been growing inside of them. Maybe the predator should have hidden one of the canals. It could have been like the end of Buck Rogers, or Buckaroo Banzai, or the it could have been like Grease. They could have landed the cloak ship right in the middle of the LA River. Nobody would go down there.
Now I'm picturing the predators racing like 50s hot rods down there.
Man, they would have so much fun. The wind blowing through their braids. They'd have a blast.
I just blasting the Beach Boys on their little radio.
Yeah. No, it's, you know, they wish they all could be California Prey. So they have, this is the end of the film, and it's just like, oh, man. On one level, like you had said last time before you had rewatched it, it is interesting because it sets up a lot of wackadoodle stuff that didn't really feature into anything up to this point and was unpredictable. But on the other hand, it's like, oh, so this doesn't actually resolve any of the things in Danny Glover's life, and it doesn't really resolve anything about police or the government or any of this stuff.
No, this is not a story about Danny Glover. It's not really a story about anyone. Yeah. So before I had rewatched it, after last week, I was all like, yeah, Predator. And I like this universe. I can't wait for them to do more stuff and more cool stuff. I was getting ready to come into this show saying like, I like how Predator 2, like Aliens, sort of expands on the universe without really sort of ruining what happened in the first movie. But now that I've watched it again, yeah, they ruined a lot of stuff from the first movie, and they didn't really expand it in a direction that helps the movie, because they were incredibly inconsistent about the things that they did, and the things that they did were kind of stupid.
Also, they hindered the future of the franchise by one little thing. Do you know what the little thing was?
I hope you're not going to say with the alien thing.
Yeah, the alien skull. Because Stan Winston just made a, you know, they're making props and stuff, and so they have an alien skull, because wouldn't that be a funny little joke? Wouldn't that be a funny little in-joke? Totally harmless. Funny little in joke that won't frustrate or anger anyone in years to come. And sure enough, that one little scene with that skull on that trophy wall from the alien spiraled out into all of the comic books and the video games and the toys. There were toy lines for these where they had you know, like different kinds of aliens that would fight different kinds of predators. And there's a whole like backstory thing, like a whole expanded universe for aliens and predators living together, frolicking through the fields. And so,
frolicking through the fields with katanas, having their showdowns.
Yeah, that all stems from just this little funny Easter egg of having a skull on the wall.
Did they do any fan fiction about the alien dinosaur skull thing that was up there too? Because that would look interesting.
Oh, I'm sure they did. I'm sure there's a ton of stuff about all of the rest of those skulls. Because once you have one important skull, then all of the other skulls have to be important, because it's all part of a greater universe that makes a whole bunch of sense.
Oh my god. I just realized that dinosaur skull is not an alien dinosaur. It's a genetically modified designed in a lab dinosaur. And I think I just cracked the plot for Jurassic World 2. Predator versus T-Rex.
But that would have, that would mean they're time traveling aliens.
Yes, and.
Oh, so maybe he didn't actually kill that guy in 1715. Maybe he just time traveled back there and killed the guy in 1715.
Not only are they the greatest hunters in the universe, they are the greatest hunters of all time, literally, because they can time travel and fight anybody, anywhere, anytime.
Oh, wow. Well, see, this is why they're probably not on great terms with Doctor Who. So, you know, he doesn't really like people meddling in time. And so I could see the battles that they would have to fight. And, you know, then you're dealing with the Doctor versus a Predator.
I didn't see any TARDIS skeletons up on the wall.
No, well, you wouldn't. They have a chameleon circuit. It was cloaked to look like one of the other skulls.
Okay, great. I don't know anything about
yes,
Doctor
and.
Who.
Yes, and. So...
They should let us write one of these.
No, they shouldn't. But
couldn't be any worse than this one.
Yeah, so that skull spiraled everything out of control and ruined everything forever. So it's not great that it's there. And all of the people who are like, yeah, that's so amazing, man. All of the people who are getting their pull lists at their local comic book shops and they're so excited by that. No, stop that. Don't be excited by that. That ruined all kinds of stuff because it just caused a whole horrible trend of all the stuff by Paul W.S. Anderson on, and even Predators, which the director and the writers and producers wanted to harken back to the original Predator movie and wanted to skip over Predator 2 and wanted to skip over the Alien versus Predator sequels stuff. Like, they wanted to, you know, oh, that got too outlandish, that got too ridiculous. Like, even they fell victim to the same stuff as these other people. Like, it's cursed. This franchise is cursed.
It's unfortunate, because I think you could do some cool stuff with that Predator.
Yeah. If only you could see the cool things to do, but it's cloaked. So the last thing I'm going to say is that I will actually rank these, and I will say that Predator is an enjoyable movie that I like watching, and Predator 2 is a bad movie I like to make fun of. And then there's the other movies, which are all various levels of garbage, and I need to rewatch the AVP movie, and I have only a vague... foggy recollection of the AVP2, but I would need to get through those ones in order to place them. But they
are.
Do you
think Predators plural is at the bottom?
It might be at the bottom just because it doesn't make any sense. And I'm saying that as someone who also thinks the other movies don't make any sense. Like, it makes most likely the least amount of sense out of any of them. Because it starts off with the bananas thing of people falling out of horrible sky stuff, and then like the rest of the movie just keeps going from there, and it's just like, yeah, and its unoriginality and attempts to redo what had come before but can't, and it struggles with what it is and what it used to be and stuff. It's just. It's not a flattering look on that film. I don't enjoy it, and it's even though it's a bad movie, and I made fun of it quite a lot on Twitter with you and Todd, the other day. I wouldn't want to go back and watch it and make fun of it anytime soon. Whereas with Predator 2, I would just, you know, pop that one and be like, oh my god, you guys have to see this. This is bananas. Like, watch this scene. Like, what is even happening there? I don't know. Do you know? I don't know. Like, where Leona grabs Bill Paxton's stuff, areas and things at the beginning. You know, you gotta grab them by the something.
She grabbed him by his trump.
Yes. Oh god. So, you know, there's funny wacky moments from this, whereas I don't necessarily see the other things as funny and wacky as much as like sad and desperate. But that's just my opinion. What about you, Dan?
I gotta say the first one was better, although, you know, the first one leaves you wanting more, which is, you know, double-edged sword, because you want more than the movie gave you, but at the same time, you don't want them to give you more bad stuff.
Katana is not a double-edged sword, Dan.
That is correct. It is a very sharp sword, by the way.
Remember the time you cut your thumb?
It was my right index finger.
Oh.
the backside, right on the knuckle. Anyway, I need to watch Predators again, probably, because that one is like a modern, like well-polished movie with a lot of money and effort put into it, and it's really bad. This one, like...
I have to disagree with your use of the word polished.
Okay. I need to rewatch it. But like, this one, there was a point where I was just like, I almost wanted to put my head down and take a short nap, because it was just like, this is not helping anything. And then like, wake me up when it gets to the meatpacking scene, because I want to see Gary Busey get his head sliced off and then drop his gallon of blood on the floor or whatever. But
yeah, wake me up when it gets to the meatpacking scene is something I say often.
Taking the time to write that in the title. Wake me up when we get to the meat packing. See. All right. I don't know. The first one is the best one. I feel like the AVP stuff should be at the very bottom. I caught like the first 20 minutes of the first AVP not too long ago, probably 3 or 4 months ago on TV, and it was just like parody levels of bad. But this versus Predators, I don't know. They were trying to hold on to the late 80s aesthetic of action movie stuff that we talked about loving so much in this movie, but they didn't do it. They didn't do it well. They didn't do it. It's just so inconsistently paced, and the energy and the things all over the place, like nothing gels together. This is like a Chex mix of bad. And I don't know what to think of it. I need to see the other one to compare, but I don't think I would enjoy throwing this one on again. I mean, I guess now that you bought it, you kind of, maybe you're like rationalizing or whatever, but I streamed it, so I don't have that feeling.
I wish I had streamed it. Maybe I should invest in Stars.
Or you could just borrow the thing. I had to AirPlay it from my phone to my TV, because I have the old Apple TV and it doesn't have a Stars app.
Oh, well, see, I have the new one and I don't have a Stars app. This is a real Magi story thing here.
It actually worked flawlessly. There was only one spot where it got a little blocky, but then it was just perfect for the entire time. They've even programmed the app that allows you to close the app and like go into Slack and talk while the movie is still AirPlaying. It worked out pretty well.
Oh, that's good. That's good, yeah. Dan.
Not everybody bothers putting that much effort in their app.
No, not a lot do. Media streaming. Isn't that a topic we love talking about? So I think we are done here. I think we should hunker down in our glowing walled spaceship with obvious seam lines and blast
random
off.
Random obelisks in the middle.
It's not really advisable. Somebody's going to stub their toe, especially with all that fog. We'll just blast off to the next adventure.
For? Were they having like a party there or something?
I think it's to represent the alien atmosphere that they typically breathe, which is somehow somewhat subtly different.
We didn't even talk about the fact that after the Predator took his mask off, he was running around with like a little oxygen mask up against his face. Like he was holding it up to breathe and then like putting it down and then screaming and then holding it up again. Like, oh God.
Yeah. Not a flattering look. I missed the part where they might have taken that out of somewhere. He carries a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm, he has like a Batman utility belt thing going on there.
It all expands. It's all futuristic stuff. You push a button and it expands.
Mm-hmm.
It's so stupid.
And we're done.
Yeah, we're done. Da 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 da